This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. I hope I don't butcher this, but Nina, is it Tychels? Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Yeah, Tychels. Soft.
Tychels. Oh, my word. I really did butcher it. Okay, well, let me try that again. Nina Tychels. Is that right? What is that?
It derives from German, and it used to have an extra H and a TZ in there, so it would have been Tychels. But, you know, in the way that names change as families emigrate, as mine did to the United States, it became Tychels.
Tychels. Okay, yeah. Well, let me just say that one last time so that it sounds better for the recording. Nina Tychels, thank you for joining me in the trenches. All right. What is your background?
I'm a journalist. I have been for more than 20 years. I started off at our National Public Radio, which is the U.S. public radio broadcasting, like the BBC is to in the UK. I did radio in Washington. I covered politics, business. I went to South America and covered from Brazil and Argentina, covered Latin American news because I had traveled a lot and I speak Spanish and Portuguese and fell in love with those countries, that continent. So I was happy to go back as a journalist. Then I did a stint on uncovering Silicon Valley when it was, I would say, in the 90s, back when if I had sold out and gotten a job in public relations, I would now be one of the great Google billionaires. But I didn't. I decided journalism was the more noble calling and at least what I was always interested in doing. And then I switched to doing print journalism because what I liked to do more was to research in greater detail. And radio journalism is wonderful and very creative in the way that you use soundscapes. But I liked doing the actual digging and research for myself. And so I wrote for various different publications, including the New York Times and The Economist as a freelancer and The New Yorker and a bunch of other publications. And then I was doing a series of investigative pieces on the food industry for a magazine no longer around, but very an excellent magazine in its day called Gourmet. And they had hired me to do these investigative stories. One of those stories was on trans fats. What were trans fats? This is the early 2000s. Nobody had any idea what they were, including me. So this was my first exposure to dietary fat, which, you know, heretofore had not interested me whatsoever, except like many young women, I had always struggled with my weight and didn't understand why, and was for decades a vegetarian. In the sense that I ate no red meat, no butter, always chose the vegetarian entree whenever possible, made my own bread, pasta salads, lived on those, and was chunky. Wrote this story on trans fats, discovered this entire world of scientists who seemed nothing like scientists to me. Stories about people who said it was my job to go and for the vegetable oil industry that hired me to go to conferences and heckle scientists who were presenting results that were unfavorable to our vegetable oils, like safflower, really? Sunflower, canola. Right. We had a team of us who would go and harass the scientists on stage. I spoke to those scientists on stage who told me about their papers getting criticized so heavily that they became paranoid. Some of them left the field because they felt so harassed. I spoke to an editor journal who talked about the margarine industry executive visiting her office and trying to get a paper yanked from the journal. This so shocked and surprised me. My father's an engineer, and I had grown up in this household of extreme naive rationality that we brought to all conversations. And I couldn't understand how this world of supposed science, how it, you know, didn't seem to have anything to do with rational science. So This piece on trans fats became a huge seller for the magazine. Actually, an interesting story there. A famous editor of the magazine who published my piece said it's one of the pieces she's most proud of. Why? Because she had to battle Procter & Gamble, which makes Crisco oil, a huge company, and they threatened to pull their advertising out of the magazine if they ran my story. And she went ahead with my story even so, and wrote about that in her memoir as an event that she was proud of. So all of these dimensions made me realize there is just a huge story out there. I got a book contract to write a book about trans fats. I spent 2 years just talking to vegetable oil scientists, right? They're called oil chemists, just learning about vegetable oils. Then I realized, well, you know, vegetable oils were brought in to replace saturated fats. What's the story on saturated fat and dietary cholesterol? That evolved into almost a decade of research. I mean, reading thousands of papers, interviewing hundreds of nutrition experts from all over the world, and, you know, ended up with a book that I really didn't even know what it was when I started my book. But at the end, my book is about, so it's the first book that really calls out the problems of inflammation, oxidation, and cancer associated or caused by seed oils, and what the history of is seed oils coming into the food supply. The unfair vilification of saturated fats, how these fats, which we've always believed are bad for us, are actually the preferable fat to choose. And then there's a chapter on the Mediterranean diet, and that is a sort of a marketing scheme, and which is kind of on its own. But yeah, I mean, I think the book basically turns on the head, like something we've obsessed about the most, you know, low fat, good fat, non-fat, you know, bad fat. It sort of turns a lot of our notions on its head, as it did for me. I mean, when I went into this book, I had no idea what I was coming out with and was completely surprised by my findings.
How far back does this go? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, why did saturated fats become the enemy?
Well, that is a good question. And like any idea, an idea can be traced to a moment in time when it is born. In the case of saturated fats, that idea goes back to the 1950s. So there's a scientist named Ansel Benjamin Keys from the University of Minnesota. He wants to understand what causes heart disease. And by the way, everybody wants to understand what causes heart disease. Heart disease was relatively rare, even though they identified it and knew about it and wrote about it in textbooks. It was rarely seen in top hospitals in the early part, in the early 1900s. By the 1950s in America and also in other parts of the world, it had become the number one killer, including President Eisenhower. Our president is out of the office with a heart attack in 1955. He's out of commission for 10 days. The entire nation is fixed on this question: what causes heart disease? And there are various theories. Vitamin deficiency is one. These are theories proposed by some leading scientists of the day. So vitamin deficiency, increasing amount of auto exhaust in the air, the type A personality that was seen increasingly in the business world, where you would go around screaming at everybody and then have a heart attack. But the theory that won out was this idea. It was called the diet heart hypothesis by Ansel Keys. And he proposed that it was saturated fat, that dietary that you ate, saturated fat in meat, mainly in meat and dairy in the US, and cholesterol. So like egg yolks, shellfish, that those foods would cause cholesterol to rise in your blood. That cholesterol would build up like plaques in your arteries. And then, you know, like hot oil down a cold stovepipe, it would eventually fill up and cause a heart attack. So every single chain of that hypothesis turned out to be wrong. But at the time, Ansel Keys was a very persuasive, aggressive, unyielding personality. He was able of winning arguments and exhausting people who defied him. He was one of the people who would stand up in audiences at conferences and criticize people to the death, as even his colleagues explained it. He was able to get on the Nutrition Committee for the American Heart Association, the most prominent group on heart disease then and now in the United States. He gets on their Nutrition Committee, and in a year, he swings the committee around to support his own hypothesis, even though there was no, you know, greater data from one year to the next, such that the American Heart Association in 1961 publishes a policy statement saying all, at the time it was just men, all men should avoid saturated fat and cholesterol, cut back on those foods as the primary prevention against heart disease. And that was the very beginning. That's the tiny acorn that grew into the giant oak tree of recommendations that we have today. It all starts with that 1961 American Heart Association recommendation. Ansel Keys, also in 1961, is on the cover of Time magazine, our very popular national magazine. The hero, the man who will conquer heart disease in our lifetimes. So that's where it began. That's how it started. And then there are many subsequent chapters, none particularly better in terms of the way the science unfolded. But we can go on that journey if you like.
It was just a few years later, maybe 15 years later, when the low-fat phase kind of started kicking in. I remember growing up, everything was low-fat. It just so happens, coincidentally, that the obesity crisis seems to have started at the same time.
Yeah. So in about 1970, the American Heart Association, again, they're driving the whole agenda on this. They say, well, let's not just avoid saturated fat. Let's avoid all fat. And their reasoning was, so there are three macronutrients of which all food is made. Those are fat, protein, and carbohydrate. Fat is 9 calories per gram, whereas protein and carbohydrate are 4 to 5 calories per gram. At the time, Americans are starting to get fat. There's the beginnings of an obesity epidemic, much less than it is today, but still it's starting. And so the logic, the totally unproven logic was, let's limit fat because it's more dense in calories. This was so naive because, you know, there was no recognition of, you know, what causes you to be satiated and feel full and not overeat is fat and protein. It's the foods that are full of fat and protein, like meat and dairy. They fill you up, and it's very hard to overeat on those foods, right? You can't overeat. They've done experiments putting pork chops in front of people, and people are like, I can't eat any more of this. Whereas we all know well how easy it is to overeat on cookies, crackers, chips, foods that are high in carbohydrate. And that is exactly what happened. The fat went down. What went up, what replaced fat was carbohydrate, in part because fat carries flavor in any food. So what they replaced that with, like say in a yogurt, they could no longer put in fat. They have to put in sort of flavor enhancers, and those are almost always carbohydrate based. So literally in every food, in order to keep the flavor without the fat, they put in additional carbohydrates, more sugar, more other kinds of flavors and textures. And that began, I mean, carbohydrates drive metabolic ill health. So it's not just obesity, but they drive diabetes, fatty liver disease. They contribute to heart disease, and it's thought also.
And heartburn.
What?
And heartburn.
And heartburn, right. As you know, there's all. Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about the major conditions. You suffered from heartburn. There are so many conditions that are seemingly unfathomably tied to excessive carbohydrate consumption. I mean, skin conditions, eczema, acne. I had sinusitis that every single year. And who knows? I mean, who would have thought that just changing my diet would eliminate that?
Nina, just to clarify, are you talking about low carbs or no carbs?
So the kinds of effects that I'm talking about happen on low carbohydrate diets, and some people think they happen more quickly or better on no carbohydrate diets. But I think that's a very individual question for people, whether or not to go merely low carbohydrate. So we're saying about 25 calories as carbohydrate, or to go zero carbs or very low, like the ketogenic diet is 20, 30 grams of carbohydrates a day. It's very individual for people in terms of how, what kind of, you know, what they need to do to see the benefits that they desire. It really depends on how long you've been metabolically unhealthy, how unhealthy you are. Everybody's an individual calculation.
But basically what you're saying is that the general trajectory is lower your carbohydrate intake if you can.
Absolutely. If you are, look, first of all, if you're suffering from any kind of health condition, you can experiment with a lower carbohydrate diet. The kind of diets that are normal, typical, that are advised by our governments are over 50% of calories as carbohydrates. That is too high for most people, especially as we age and we start to accumulate various kinds of health problems. Anybody can benefit from reducing their carbohydrates. It's definitely closer to what we believe to have been the natural human diet. Like the humans evolved really without major amounts of agriculture. Agriculture came later. So we were basically eating protein, meat, fat. That was fish, eggs. I mean, that's the natural human diet. And some people need to get very close to that to see the kind of benefits that they hope for. For instance, there's people who go carnivore, which is all the way extreme on that, along this continuum we're talking about. People who are going carnivore are having some, I think almost like miraculous outcomes. They're reporting that they're recovering from autoimmune conditions. I mean, this is still, you know, in the anecdotal phases, but there are things that have been considered impossible. Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, things that just haven't been seen. Bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, those findings are actually now have been replicated in two clinical trials that you can reverse schizophrenia disorder and bipolar disorder. I mean, who would have thought that was considered an absolutely intractable and irreversible condition? It sounds almost unrealistic or tin-hatted or something to say this, but these are what, you know, real people are reporting, and there are increasing numbers of case reports being written up in medical journals. And it's not impossible, you know, that where there's something about the food supply that is actually poisoning us and giving us these conditions.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. I've seen a few counter arguments over the years from people saying, it's not carbohydrates. What you're actually referring to is just processed foods and too much sugar.
So I just actually did a very deep dive into the processed food argument. Let's separate that out from the sugar argument. So processed foods, and I've written about this. I write a column on a platform called Substack, and the column is called Unsettled Science, if people want to go there and read about this. The definition of processed foods is not a definition, like not by any scientific standards. It includes so many different things as to be just meaningless. It includes the degree of processing and certain ingredients like salt and fat, but how much of those ingredients, it doesn't say. It includes the way that the food is packaged and marketed. If it's in brightly colored packaging, it's a processed food. Well, does that mean apples in brightly colored packaging are processed foods? No, but you know, how do you even begin to try to define what processed food is? I actually use a quote from one of our Supreme Court justices when he was talking about trying to define obscenity, which was a Supreme Court case. And he said, you know, I know it when I see it. And that's kind of the way it is with processed food. Like we all sort of know it when we see it, but you cannot define it to study it. Really, it's almost impossible. And whether those foods are less healthy or there's something about the processing that contributes to their ill health, has not actually been studied. So in the sense that it hasn't been studied in a clinical trial. I think that it's a very convenient buzzword. I have used it myself to describe all the junk food out there, right? There's just so much junk food in those middle supermarket aisles. It's almost all made of three or four ingredients, which is salt, grains, vegetable oils, and sugar, maybe, you know, cereals, crackers, chips. Like, we all know that's junk food, but is it the processing or is it the grains and the sugar and the vegetable oils and maybe too much salt? Like, is that the problem or is it the processing? And there are no studies to answer that question. So I think it's a nice buzzword. I was perfectly happy with the buzzword junk food. I think it describes the same thing, which is like a bunch of crap food that we know is crap. But the state of the science is really extremely poor. And I think in some ways, in my more cynical mind, which has developed over the years as I see food politics and how they unfold, I think it's very possibly sort of a term that's been developed almost to divert our attention away from the real problem, really, which are, what are the actual food items that are making us sick? That are, you know, those are excessive carbohydrates and, you know, grains and sugar. Okay, to your question about sugar, sugar is a carbohydrate. How many experiments have been done showing just taking sugar out and leaving all the other grains and all the other carbohydrates in? This many. So we really don't know if sugar, and we have very little data just looking at sugar. It seems to be worse, seems to be addictive. But the large body of rigorous clinical trial research really shows that you have to reduce total carbohydrates. So sugars, grains, sweet, very sweet fruits, you have to reduce them all to get the kind of benefits that we that are seeing. You know, reversal of type 2 diabetes diagnosis, significant weight loss, reversal of fatty liver disorder. I mean, that's where you see the kinds of health outcomes that, you know, you're hoping for, we're all hoping for.
Is a calorie a calorie?
No. Calorie counting has been shown already by 1950s. They had done like 100 studies showing that counting calories did not help people lose weight. Counting calories is not helpful because let me give you just a couple reasons. One, I already mentioned, fat and protein are more satiating. Especially the protein. If you are eating those calories, if you have eggs for breakfast, you are not hungry for the morning till lunchtime, maybe later. Those calories fill you up and satiate you for whatever reason, right? Look, there's some biochemistry there. Maybe those foods also provide you the nutrients that you really need. Like it's fat and protein are essential for your body. Like, you can't live without them. Carbohydrates are calories that are not only not essential, you don't need to eat them, but they spur overeating. And they do that because they spike your blood glucose, your blood sugar. And then after it's spiked, it plunges. And down here in the bottom of the plunge, that's hunger, extreme hunger. Those are the people like, they can't find the granola bar fast enough because they're super hungry. So, and then you eat more carbohydrates, it spikes it up again, and then it goes down and you're hungry again. So they encourage
and tired. Overeat.
They encourage binging and overeating, excessive eating that happens on carbohydrates. So those are just some of the difference of those different kinds of calories. It's also true that carbohydrates, when it spikes your blood sugar, it triggers an insulin response. That insulin response delivered by your pancreas, that shuts down any access you have to your body's fat stores, so you can no longer burn your own fat, so you can't be losing weight. Like, so it shuts down any weight loss. So there's very different reactions in your body that happen due to different types of calories. And a calorie is, there's just no equivalence that can be made. That's what calorie counting, calories in, calories out, all of that is just, it's not helpful for weight loss or for guiding your eating habits. Another effect, you know, those afternoon slumps that people have in their energy, that happens because you're zonked out from your carbohydrate low. coming down of your grain salad or whatever you've had for lunch. And then people on low carbohydrate diets uniformly report better mood, better energy. Often people get off antidepressants too. The folks promoting calories in, calories out is the food industry, because they want you to think your 100 calories of Coke, you can work that off, number one, so it has no effect on you. That's exactly the same as 100 calories of anything else. It benefits the food industry.
Again, for clarity, when we talk about carbohydrates, what are we talking about? Because you often hear, well, that's a simple carbohydrate, or that's a complex carbohydrate.
Simple carbohydrates are the more easily, quickly digested kinds. You can think like white rice versus brown rice, or whole grains versus refined grains. And again, I'd want to make the overarching point that it's reducing total carbohydrates that allows you to see the kind of health results that you might desire. There really is almost nothing meaningful about like slow carbs versus fat carbs. There's also the downside of whole grains, which nobody really talks about much, but the whole grain carries more of the anti-nutrient, like they're called phytates is one of them. But like the husks on the rice are very high in phytate that inhibits mineral absorption. There's a reason that the Japanese eat white rice. And all cultures were eating white rice until in the 70s. And, you know, my liberal hometown of Berkeley, California, were like, we're just going to have the natural brown rice. But in fact, that's much higher in the kinds of anti-nutrients that inhibit the absorption of vitamins and minerals and have other effects. So I don't think there's any benefit in eating whole grains. You know, there are people who think that root vegetables, especially sweet potatoes, in the paleo movement, they embrace a lot of those root vegetables. I still think the results are not as impressive in terms of health outcomes when you have carbohydrates in your diet. I also know and recognize that there are a number of influencers who have reintroduced fruit into their diets, and maybe quite a lot of it. And there, I would like to make the point that people who are healthy, lean, these are all men, right? They're healthy, lean men who are drinking fruit juice and having more fruit. That is okay for them. It is not okay for if you are struggling with your weight, if you are, you know, have any kind of condition. I mean, what happens with these influencers, I've seen this, I don't need to name names, but you know, they start off with some health problems. They're on this ketogenic diet or a carnivore diet for years. They get incredibly healthy. Now they're super lean, they're in fantastic condition. And like a 19-year-old boy who plays soccer, you know, six times a week, they can eat pretty much anything, right? I mean, we all know, like, we know that's like what a young person, you can restore your body to that level. I haven't, you know, I don't go and look at their cardiovascular risk panel. I think there's still a danger in eating a lot of fruit. But I'm telling you, those people can metabolize that. But if you give that fruit to me as a middle-aged woman or to anybody with any kind of serious health condition, that they cannot tolerate, or somebody with diabetes, forget it. Like, you just cannot tolerate those carbohydrates. Starch molecules, for instance, in your whole grain cereal, in your oats, I mean, those are just sugar molecules holding hands. And the moment that you eat your bowl of oats, those become sugar in your body. I mean, it instantly converts to sugar. So you're really not doing yourself any favors by eating it really any kind of grains at all.
I have a overlapping question because we're talking about sugar, and I've also heard this. Well, you get different types of sugar, sucrose and fructose. You know, if you eat an apple, then that sugar is healthy.
I don't distinguish between different types of sugar. They all have the same effect on your blood sugar. One thing that people can do to answer some of these questions for themselves, I don't know what the availability is in your part of the world, but if you slap on a continuous glucose monitor, you know, you can put one like under your arm, you follow it for 2 weeks, eat some honey. See what that does. Eat different kinds of sugar. See what that does. Eat your grains. See what that does. I mean, you can discover this information for yourself. You don't need to. This is why CGMs, as they're called, are so powerful, because you do not need to rely on your dietitian, who's almost always giving you misinformation, to tell you it's fine to put sugar on, you know, to put honey on your cereal. The other thing that people say, oh, fructose in fruit is okay. First of all, fructose is processed by your liver. It goes straight to your liver. People eating high fruit often get fatty liver, right? Because they're depositing all that sugar right into their liver. And so they develop fat stores around it. So table sugar is made up of half glucose, half fructose. Okay, that's table sugar. Those two, glucose and fructose, almost always come together. Even in fruit, we think of it as fructose, but there's also glucose in there. Those two are almost never separated in nature, in food. You are always getting glucose, which spikes your blood sugar, and you're always getting fructose, which goes to your liver.
So the rule of thumb is if it's sweet, it's got sugar.
Yeah, unless it's a replacement sweetener like erythritol, or, you know, there's allulose. There are various different kinds of fake sweeteners. But in general, if you are trying to get on a low carbohydrate diet, it helps a lot to try to wean yourself from the taste of sweetness. So even getting off those sugar replacements is helpful. I'm not a doctor and I don't see clients, but I, you know, have counseled many, many people through starting low carbohydrate diets. And what I see is that people should really plan to fail. And when you start, most people are sugar addicted. Sugar addiction is real. Do you know the first food that was ever reported as being addictive was in the 1850s was chocolate. Sugar and the cacao had started to be imported from colonies to England and Europe. So chocolate was widely considered the most addictive substance for 100 years. But sugar is addictive. Most people are addicted to sugar in some form or another, or to the grains that become sugar in your body. And so when you start, you really have to plan to fail. And if that failure means having some keto bars around or some sugar replacement sweeteners that you're just going to like dump into a bowl of whipped cream because you have a craving, you need to plan for that. You cannot assume that you're perfect. And eventually, your body will start weaning itself off sugar. Doing that through sugar sweetener replacements is, I think, totally fine. And then eventually you hopefully get to a point where you're no longer craving sweet things. And then you really are free from them. You know, you go even in the sugar shop, you know, you just aren't tempted by what you see. And that would have been impossible for me to imagine when I started out. I was such a sugarholic, but your palate, your actual palate just changes over time.
When we talk about eating more meat and more saturated fats, the elephant in the room is cholesterol, the big scary monster.
Raising your cholesterol in your blood is the fear that comes with, yeah. So red meat was originally condemned due to its saturated fat content, right? Just for everybody to understand, meat and all foods are not just any one fat, right? So meat is maybe 40% saturated, and its fats are 40% saturated, and then some are unsaturated like olive oil, and some are polyunsaturated. So every food is a mixture of different kinds of fats. But let's just say there's more saturated fat in meat and dairy. Those will raise your LDL cholesterol, which is your so-called bad cholesterol, a little bit. And what has been found is that that rise is transient over time. In a very select population of people called lean mass hyperresponders, which I won't get into, but super fit people on a low carb diet can have a very high increase in their cholesterol. So that's like its own little subgroup, and it's being studied. But for most people, there's a little rise in LDL cholesterol, and that's why meat is feared as causing heart disease. However, just going back to Ansel Keys for a second, after he came out, he was on the cover of Time magazine, and the American Heart Association came out with that statement in 1961. What happened? Well, governments around the world were curious to know, is what Ansel Keys is saying actually true? So they undertook large, well-controlled, randomized controlled clinical trials, so like grade top grade A evidence. These were conducted on some 76,000 people in places like Norway, Australia, the US, the UK. Huge number of people were tested on Ancel Keys' hypothesis. And what did they find? When they replaced saturated fats with unsaturated vegetable oils, so instead of meat, they had, you know, whatever fake meat there was in those days, right? Their version of the Impossible Burger. Instead of cheese, they had soy-filled cheese. Instead of milk, they had soy-filled milk. So they did these experiments. They did see in the vegetable oil group, they saw cholesterol go down. So total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol went down. That seemed to be a good sign showing, oh, these people have lowered their cardiovascular risk by giving up meat and dairy. However, these studies, which were hugely ambitious, lasted long enough to measure more definitive outcomes, cardiovascular events, heart attack, stroke, and death. Death is the best outcome, not because we're happy about people dying, but death is indisputable. Death is what we call a hard endpoint. It's even better than like a heart attack, because doctors will report heart attacks and identify them in different ways, and sometimes you don't catch them. So, but in all of these experiments on 76,000 people, they discovered that people who had more saturated fat, more meat and dairy, did not die at higher rates from cardiovascular mortality or total mortality from any cause. They did not have, for the most part, most studies found they did not have higher rates of heart attacks, and they had lower rates of stroke. So that's the outcome from the most rigorous evidence we have from clinical trials. And why do we not know about that? Why are they not informing our dietary guidelines? That is, the answer to that is a purely political explanation, which is that that data has been systematically ignored and buried. And I've been writing about this, and I'm currently trying to get it into a mainstream publication because it's so controversial. But, you know, literally, like the World Health Organization, which just came out with a guideline last year on saturated fat saying, you know, limit your saturated fat consumption, they completely ignored the data on mortality from these clinical trials. They just ignored it. The U.S. Guideline Committee has ignored the data. They just ignore it, even though that's the most rigorous data that exists. And that's like they're doing an end run around the data, and they're trying to re-suppress it. Why do I say re-suppress it? Because these trials were all done in the 60s and 70s, and then they were suppressed for decades. Some of them weren't published. Some of them were buried in the basement of our National Institutes of Health. They were ignored. Then through my work and the work of Gary Taubes, these trials kind of came back to light. I would say especially from my book, because I really focused on this particular issue. The trials come back to light. This is 2014. The last decade has seen a major reconsideration of saturated fats. At least 25 papers saying we got it wrong on saturated fats, reanalyzing all this data, looking at this clinical trial data that people didn't even know existed. There's a huge renaissance in thinking on saturated fats, but now we're entering a period where it's being buried all over again.
So put another way, having higher cholesterol is not necessarily the enemy.
So I would say that there has never been a diet trial. Lowering your cholesterol through diet by reducing your saturated fats does not produce cardiovascular benefits. It may be that lowering your cholesterol with a statin or a PCSK9 inhibitor might prevent cardiovascular risk, but I really don't know. I don't analyze that data. I know it's very controversial, but I will tell you that through diet, you are not improving your cardiovascular risk.
Nina, how do you explain Asia? We keep hearing about how much rice and carbohydrates they eat, and they're all very thin.
I think that there's a couple of explanations. One is that historically they were on something close to starvation diets. They were eating very few calories, and they were not eating. They just ate so few calories that they just didn't gain weight. That was like the case for most of their history. When they started eating more more meat and dairy in Japan, especially, actually their rates of heart disease went down since the 1970s. They've dramatically increased their intake of animal foods and their rates of heart disease have gone down. Their thinness could be, I just think it seems like there's a clearly some kind of genetic difference there. I mean, there are clearly some people, there are some populations that fatten more easily than other populations. And to me, I mean, maybe this is politically incorrect to say, but I mean, I look at Asians and they just clearly are not like, they're just not easily fattened people compared to other populations. But I think it's, we also have to consider that it's very possible that there's something uniquely fattening about our carbohydrates now. There's something about the GMO production of them or the way that the grains have been altered that we use. We've really interfered with our grains to such an extent that we don't even know. There may be something about the kinds of carbohydrates we eat now that makes them uniquely fattening. So I think that, I mean, that's sort of the best explanation I can give. I think that if you brought, and actually this happened in there's a experiment called an observational study called Nihon Sun, where they found that people, Japanese who emigrated to the United States, started to get fat and look just like Americans did when they shifted over to the American food supply. Whatever's going on in Japan, I just don't think is transferable to our Western experience.
Perhaps to strengthen the one point you made earlier, our grandparents and great-grandparents didn't really get fat, but they would eat perhaps roast chicken with gravy and rice and roast potatoes. But as you're saying, perhaps there's something different about the carbohydrates today.
You will see if you get a glucose meter that your carbohydrate spike is not as high when you're eating your carbs after your protein and your fat. So taking the example of your grandparents' Sunday roast or whatever they ate, they would have had potatoes with that, right? But they were eating a whole roast beef or a roast chicken or whatever they were eating, and they had it doused in butter. Nobody was afraid of fat at the time, right? If your meal is balanced like that, the carbohydrates have less of an impact on your blood sugar. And so they're perhaps not as damaging. So I think one of the reasons we see like the obesity epidemic is that we've removed those foods, we removed protein and fats. It was completely normal to have a roast, some piece of meat, several nights a week. It was completely normal until the cereal industry came along to have steak for breakfast in America. A T-bone steak was the most common steak in America. So we had much, much more protein in our diet, I guess is what I'm saying. And that very well could have blunted the impact of the carbohydrates that we also obviously ate.
But Nina, you're just saying this because you're funded by the meat industry.
Yeah, right. So, you know, one of the things that I learned from my research was that part of the serious bullying that goes on in nutrition science, and this was really pioneered by Ansel Keys and his colleagues, who would, one of their standard tactics was, when they disagreed with another scientist, they would accuse them of being funded, of having financial conflicts of interest. And this is how Ansel Keys went after John Yudkin, who was the one who was promoting the idea in England that sugar caused heart disease, not fat, which we now know is probably much more likely to be true. But Ansel Keys went after him saying, you know, you just have financial backers and you're corrupt. And anyway, so having reported on this in my book, and in my work, I should not have been surprised that this exact same tactic was then turned on me. And so it has been, there's, you know, an effort, like a whisper campaign to try to suggest that I take money from the meat industry, but I don't. And there's never been any evidence discovered that I do, because I do not. After I wrote my book, I was invited to give some speeches to groups that are involved in meat and dairy production. But it's not like nobody's ever paid for my research or my work from any industry.
We were talking about Asia earlier, and I forgot to ask you, what do you make of the China study? I mean, that has been cited many times over the years.
I looked into the China study. There's an excellent analysis by of of the whole study by a woman named Denise Minger that was done many years ago. The first thing that I discovered was it's never been published in a peer-reviewed journal. This is often done with works that are subpar. They are slipped into a supplemental issue, and those from journals that are not peer-reviewed. So it's not published in a peer-reviewed publication. That should raise a lot of red flags. One of the things he did is he omitted one of the Chinese provinces that was ate a lot of meat and looked very healthy, and he decided not to include that province. And Denise Minger goes into more detail about some of the various methodological problems in his study. But ultimately, he was showing an association, not a causation. And just to give an example of why that could be wrong, it could be that poor people who don't have enough to eat and are living on starvation rations because they're poor are then also suffering from health problems, but it's not their diet that's caused them. It's the poverty that caused them. That's you can't know from a large observational study at a country level what is going on with in terms of the causality, the direction of causality.
I actually read Denise's review many years ago, now that you mention it. And I remember at the same time, not quite related, but an interesting counter argument just coincidentally came out by Gary Tobbs. I think it was Why We Get Fat. And he was looking at poverty-stricken regions in Africa. And how is it that poor people are obese? And it turns out that part of that vector was pointing towards UN food aid, which was just grain and more grain and more grain.
Right. Well, I mean, there is that paradox of obesity in the presence of poverty, which Gary also pointed out in the Pima Indians, who were completely obese. But again, the government food supplies were all corn. But mainly when you're looking at population level data, you just don't know. It's considered lowest quality data that exists. You're not tying an individual's diet to their particular health outcome. You can't say anything about causation.
I can't believe I'm going to ask you this.
What do I eat?
No. Some of my best friends are vegan.
Well, yeah.
You know where I'm going. I suppose what I'm going to ask is, where does a plant-based diet fit in with this sort of thing? If you wanted to have a low carbohydrate lifestyle and you don't want to eat animals, which I can understand to some degree, you've got a very tough time ahead of you.
It's not impossible. I know people who have done it. And I know that Virta Health, a company here in the U.S., has a protocol for, I mean, vegetarians, you do much better if you can eat vegetarian food, you know, eggs and cheese. I think it is possible to go on a low carb diet, but it's just extreme. Like, you have to be just absolutely religiously careful about what you eat if you're going to do it low carb. I can't give you the exact prescription for that diet, but I think it's extremely important to supplement with, you know, B vitamins, especially B12, omega-3s. There's a long list of supplements you need because the vegan diet is inherently deficient in essential nutrients. And you can't get vitamin A from carrots. It's not the kind that you can absorb. You can't get omega-3s from omega-3 eggs. It's not in the form you can absorb. So you really have to learn about where the bioavailable source of these vitamins comes from. And then you have to take that in a lot of supplements. I have a good friend who is vegan for a very long time. She didn't want to kill animals. She hated the idea of going off of her diet. And she had to, almost like a mantra, repeat to herself that because she was having health problems and she knew that she needed to eat some animal foods, most likely to solve those problems. And she kept repeating to herself that this is what her body needed, that she's an animal. We can go on a vegan diet no more than a lion can go on a vegan diet. Like, we, our bodies, our biology is not programmed for those diets. And to have, like, respect and in our bodily needs, which may not, may be so hard for our brains to accept, but our bodies just have requirements that can't be denied. And to have compassion for what the body does need to survive. I have tremendous sympathy for people in this position because I know that their feelings about it are very strong. I see it as a challenge of trying to remind people that they do have this biological essentiality that needs to be respected if they're going to thrive as human beings.
I actually eat a plant-based diet. I go hunting with my friends and I shoot animals that eat plants.
Right.
But yeah, jokes aside, I mean, that's obviously a very healthy protein because, I mean, that's quite literally free range.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't evolve to eat grass. You know, we're lucky that we have these animals that with several stomachs through that, you know, it's like a multi-part process to convert that into food that we can eat. Like, how lucky are we to have these brilliant animals that become proteins that we can consume? We're not meant to eat a lot of leaves and shoots. That's not what our biology requires, and we can't digest them.
You raise an interesting point, Nina, and it's something that I've heard for years. Just have a balanced diet. If you have a little bit of carbs and a little bit of protein and a little bit of fat, then you're fine.
Yeah, that is another corporate concept that was developed by the cereal companies who wanted people to start having more cereals in their diets. And it sounds so reasonable. Balance in all things, right? A kind of Jungian principle. However, if somehow some extremely well-funded, drug dealer came along and say, let's have a little more balance with, let's put some more nicotine in the diet and let's have a balanced diet around various narcotics. I mean, that's sort of what's happened now. We build things that we think ought to be in our diet really don't need to be there. There's some substances that you don't need to have as part of a balanced plate. And, you know, even if that sounds good, the science simply doesn't support it. The science does not support there's no balanced diet experiment that shows dramatically improved health outcomes, right? I mean, when they have tested the diet that the government recommends, one of the largest clinical trials that was ever undertaken, and that was on, you know, the five food groups or the four food groups, which was dairy, protein, grains, vegetables, and fruit, balanced. That study, after 8 years involving 49,000 women, called the Women's Health Initiative, showed no benefit, no ability to contribute to weight loss, no ability to prevent diabetes or heart disease or any kind of cancer, and it had been powered for cancer. So that diet, you know, sounds a nice little homily, but it just doesn't produce results.
You thought I was going to ask you earlier about what you eat, so I'm going to ask you that. What do you eat in general?
I'm sure this is really boring for most people. So, I mean, I don't eat until 1 or 2 in the afternoon. I start my day off and I just have black coffee. Then at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, I have a few eggs with cheese that I cook and in various different ways. And that's really boring. And then I cook dinner for my family, I have two young men as sons and my husband, and they're not low carb. So, you know, I cook some kind of meat and, chicken or fish or steaks or red meat or whatever. I have a whole bunch of recipes. And then I often have a bowl of rice. You know, I cook a pot of rice for my kids because they like it, or some other starch because they're just like wildly athletic and they need tons of calories and they like it. So, and then some vegetable and that's it.
But there's an interesting meta conversation there. You said that they're athletic and you were making the connection to carbohydrates. Now, is there actually a legitimate connection between carbohydrates and gym?
Well, I think, you know, you're a friend of Tim Nook, so you know that he does not believe carbohydrates are necessary for athletic performance. And I myself am not an athlete. And so I don't have any strong opinion about it. I think that what his latest work shows that, so it's definitely not, carbohydrates are definitely not necessary for long haul kinds of events like marathons or triathlons or whatever. They found that people do just as well in those races if they are burning fat. But that's some, that there may, it may be necessary for sort of short, intense exercise to take in some carbohydrates. I think there's no evidence that like carb loading before a marathon is with any superior as a strategy to just, or to being a ketogenic fat burner. But, you know, I'm just saying, like, if you're metabolically healthy, you're, you know, a teenager is metabolically healthy, I think that at that point, and you're thin and your health, everything about you is healthy, that you can eat some carbs and it's just not an issue. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm condemning my poor child, but like, he doesn't eat a lot of candy. He just doesn't eat junk. I have another child who does fatten more easily and he's more careful.
All right. As we come in for a bit of a landing, I'm going to tap, if you don't mind, into the sacrilegious. I enjoy red wine and whiskey. Alcohol, Nina. Where do we go with this?
I'm not condemning you on that. Why is that sacrilegious? I understand people think it's a poison, that alcohol is a poison. Not all. So, you know, straight up alcohol, hard alcohol is not a carbohydrate. Wine has a few carbohydrates in it. When you're digest, it's the first thing your body needs to digest. So if you drink something, your body like prioritizes digesting ethanol, which is why like drinking at night can mess your sleep. I'm not a purist about that. I mean, there was a book in the 1950s in America called The Drinking Man's Diet, which was all about have a lot of alcohol, but just keep the carbs low. And then Vogue magazine repeated that, a version of that in the 80s. And it was like, oh, a glass of Chablis with lunch and a glass of Chardonnay with dinner. I mean, I don't, you know, I think you can get pretty decent results for weight loss and still drink alcohol. I know other people just think are much more purist about it. The main finding of my work is that saturated fats have been unfairly vilified and are not bad for health and are not a reason to avoid eating red meat and dairy, which are actually extremely nutrient dense, protein rich foods that are essential for good health. It's also true that reducing grains, starches, sugars, sweet fruit has been shown in large clinical trials to improve virtually all diet-related health conditions. And also that avoiding seed oils will improve health by reducing your risk of inflammation, which drives heart disease, and also very likely lower your risk of cancer.
I almost forgot to ask you, and if you don't mind, I'm going to quickly ask you, you mentioned seed oils. Something that I was told when I was young is that if you fry olive oil, it turns to trans fats and becomes bad for you, that sort of thing. Is that also all just a myth?
Olive oil? No, That's untrue. If you want a short primer on heating oils, olive oil is called oleic acid, fatty acid. And those molecules only have one double bond in them. That's only one opportunity to open up and attach to oxygen molecules. And that's oxidation, which you don't want happening because oxidation drives inflammation. So olive oil is not only one double bond, not bad. It's seed oils, sunflower, safflower, canola, have those molecules have multiple double bonds in them. So multiple opportunities to, the bond opens up, attaches to oxygens, oxidizes, causes inflammation. Over here is saturated fats, no double bonds, no opportunity for oxidizing. That's why they're called saturated. They're saturated with hydrogens, and that's why there are no double bonds. So you've got over, saturated is the most stable, no oxidation. polyunsaturated vegetable oils, seed oils, multiple double bonds, highly likely to oxidize and cause inflammation. Olive oil is right in between with one double bond. It's the most stable oil.
What about coconut oil?
Coconut oil is, that's a good one to bring up, is unusual for an oil, and why it's generally solid at room temperature is that it's 89% saturated. It is largely saturated, meaning no oxidation.
So it's safe.
And palm oil is the same way. That's why palm oil is often used in packaged foods because it gives them the stability. All those packaged foods need a stable fat. They can't, like, you can't put an oil in there. They're greasy, falling apart, they oxidize easily. So you need a stable fat to stabilize those processed foods on the supermarket shelves.
So olive oil and coconut oil are somewhat safe.
Yes, they are. In general, the more solid the fat is, the more saturated, and that makes it better for cooking. So lard, tallow, suet, ghee, all solid fats. And butter, of course. So those are safe for cooking because, of course, all these chemical reactions I'm talking about the double bonds opening up and oxidizing, all of that, as you know from chemistry experiments, it all speeds up when you add heat. So you want to cook with saturated fats to be safe.
Okay, Nina, how can I follow your work?
So I'm on Twitter, X, under @ Big Fat Surprise. Or you can find me on my column on Substack called Unsettled Science, which you can sign up for free.
I hope I don't butcher this again. Nina Tarsholds, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's really nice to talk to you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.